this one I can drag out.
Something steamy. Last week, Northern Rail ran the first timetable steam train service in 50 years. Yeah? You like that? I can sense you're getting a bit hot under the collar, and that's because we're talking steam on The Rest Is Noise, a podcast where each week we search for the perfect music to embody a concept, person, people, place, or thing. I'm your host, Martin, and letting off steam this week are the esteemed Ian, full steam ahead, it's Nathan, and our very own steampunk, Richie. Ian, are you a sauna or a steam room kind of guy?
Neither. I'm averse to getting any sort of naked in public. Being really, really hot is quite uncomfortable. I don't know why people would do that for pleasure, really.
You prefer the cold?
I prefer a moderate body heat.
How have you interpreted steam this week, Nathan?
Incredibly literally. More will be revealed later. I don't want to give too much away now because that would spoil the surprise or the disappointment.
Well, we're going to start this week with Richie. Rich, what have you got for us?
Steamboat by the Beach Boys. So it was from 1973's Holland, recorded in Holland. Written by Dennis Wilson and their manager Jack Riley, and sung by Dennis and Carl Wilson. Basically, the end of the 60s, Brian Wilson and his involvement in the Beach Boys had kind of diminished. In 1969, he decided to open a short-lived health food store called Radiant Radish, because it was there he met said manager Jack Riley, who was a journalist and presenter, and they got pally over vegetables or whatever it was. And he kind of came to Brian and said, look, here is my manifesto for how to make the Beach Boys more popular. Since they'd had their mega hits of the mid 60s, they'd done right, but you know, they weren't kind of the force they were. So he came up with a few points, one being they needed more socially conscious lyrics, and two, he officially gave Carl Wilson the title of musical director. And Carl Wilson, I think, is probably one of the most underrated figures in musical history. He basically kept the Beach Boys together since 67. He'd been, while Brian was very much sort of the songwriting and production force, Carl was the musical force of the band. It prompted basically my favourite period of Beach Boys history, which was only 3 years long, but they managed to produce Sunflower, Surf's Up, Carl and the Passions, and Holland. And there's a particular period within that, which was the last two records, Carl and the Passions and Holland, 72 and 73, where Carl brought in two South Africans from a band called The Flames, Blondie Chaplin on guitar and Ricky Fattar on drums. And he was basically, by doing that, kind of injecting new life into the Beach Boys. Gone were the days of kind of their famous five-part harmonies and sort of fairly flat lyrics. They'd gone a bit more interesting. Skip forward to this point, and they've got this song about a steamboat. The final lyrics in it are, "Don't worry, Mr. Fulton, we'll get your steamboat going," which, the Mr. Fulton in that line is Robert Fulton, who basically invented steamboats. So there's some good steam running through this song. So in 1807, this very steamboat of his took people from New York to Albany and back again. He also invented torpedoes.
Steam-powered.
Unspecified, maybe. And he has a good death. He was walking across the frozen Hudson, as one would, with his mate. His mate fell through the ice. He went in to rescue him and died shortly after of consumption.
He died in the water of consumption, or he got out of the water.
He got out of the water and later died of, right. of consumption
because of
the cold. So he probably was quite literally steaming when he came out of the water.
Did he consume any of the vegetables at the Radiant Radish? And part B to my question is, were any of those vegetables steamed? Weren't they a bit of a mess at this period, though? Like, Brian was in and out of the studio just in a kind of haze. The song, to me, reflects the kind of mess they seem to be in out of the recording studio. Is that fair of saying? It's kind of got this chugging, woozy, sort of slow, almost drunk, stoned feel. Like, you're on a steamboat and it's kind of lurching back and forth. And
kind of. I mean, actually, Brian was all but removed from this whole process.
He didn't have a huge amount to do with them. At this point,
I think he's got 2 credits on this. So actually, when Holland was released, there was this mad, like, tacked on EP, which is this bizarre musical fairy tale narrated by Jack Riley, the manager, and that was the bit that Brian had dealings with. But basically, when the songwriting was split all over the place, but Dennis, Carl, Lonnie Chaplin, Mike Love did a bit, this and that, so. It was kind of, as a band, they were probably more cohesive than they had been at any point. But yes, as a broader thing, and Brian Wilson, it was quite fractured. And this studio they set up in Utrecht was shipped out from California, and they like rebuilt it in a cow field. And they sort of said it was a bit mad. We were in the middle of nowhere. I'm still not quite sure why they went to record out there. Whatever the troubles were, I'm not saying, you know, obviously Dennis had his issues, but it somehow made them a lot more sonically interesting and adventurous.
I wanted to talk a bit, you mentioned this era of Beach Boys is where they decided they were going to write more socially conscious lyrics in order to become more popular. What is socially conscious about, what is this song about to you?
This song is about a trip on a steamboat. It was probably a failed experiment, their socially conscious lyrics. Bear in mind, they have that song about day in the life of a tree.
Because when you mentioned socially conscious, I thought of 2 songs from Surf's Up, which count amongst some of the weakest songs that I did. Which one was Student Demonstration Time.
Oh,
which is terrible, yeah. Right? Song. Absolutely, yeah. Terrible.
Agreed.
And the other is Don't Go Near the Water.
I quite like that one.
But that could be about Robert Fulton as well, couldn't it?
Yeah,
or Dennis Wilson.
Well, there was a weird... I'm glad you put it. There was a weird obsession with water.
Yes.
Over this whole... So Surf's Up, Don't Go Near the Water, Cool Water, this song, like there's a big water.
Will it make
theme.
It, I think it makes sense when you think about all their earlier songs were about surfing.
Yeah.
Right? And the joy, the communal joy of surfing together and what that was all about. So it makes sense that when they're sort of decaying and when mental illness and substance abuse are setting in, they might start contemplating what the water means in other respects.
Maybe that was their accidental social conscience coming through.
Yeah. If they do it accidentally, they're quite good at it. But if they did it deliberately, I thought they were quite
good
at it.
I think the ones where they tried deliberately were, you're completely right, some of the worst things they did.
I think they succeeded completely with Take Good Care of Your Feet, personally.
Oh, God, I've forgotten about that one, yeah.
Yeah.
Which the rhyme to Take Good Care of Your Feet is Pete.
Yeah.
I'm inclined to agree with you about this period of the Beach Boys being, I don't know whether it's up there with my favourite because it's patchy. I think we've kind of established, even on the albums, my favourite of that period is Surf's Up, but there's still some weak points on it. It's not as solid as Pet Sounds, but I do think it is really interesting. There is this kind of theme of them writing a song and then trying to make it sound in a really literal way, like it. You can always hear that kind of really slow steamboat lurching down the river. It's almost like Brian's absence freed them to be as ridiculous as they wanted to be.
Don't listen to Carl Wilson's solo records. I found them, they're dreadful, and it ruined my perception of a man I've championed for a long time.
He's got the voice of melted caramel.
I think for too long, people just go, Beach Boys, Brian Wilson, next, you know.
Yeah.
And then Dennis was kind of the hipster outsider one that people latched onto for Pacific Ocean Blue, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. But Carl basically held the band together for so many years and wrote and sang and produced so many of my favourite things. So, this one's for you, Carl.
My favourite Beach Boy for the record? Glen Campbell. Ian, what's your choice this week?
My choice is Donna Summer and Love to Love You, Baby. Thank you. Steamy, adjective, informal, depicting or involving passionate sexual activity. For that reason, I argue this slab of sultry disco funk is a steamiest 16 and a half minutes committed to any format. The steam is alluded to by the loose, loush bassline, the way the rhythm section drops in and out, and the repeated suggestive lyrics. Do it to me, again and again. You put me in such an awful spin, in a spin, in a. The clincher, though, is it's actually involving sexual activity. According to the BBC, the song contains 23 orgasms. It's unclear who at the BBC is responsible for counting them, although I'm sure we could have our guesses, but it led to them refusing to promote or play it. Indeed, the song is so sexy that Summer herself renounced it when she became a born-again Christian, and even she refused to play it live. You can't get much closer than the dictionary definition of steamy.
I agree with you. It fits it very nicely. But for me, Ian, you've chosen the wrong song. I think there is a steamier song from the same era. One that doesn't feature almost parody levels of flute and wah-wah guitar. They've dated quite badly.
Well, I was going to say that it is around 7.5 minutes in and Donna starts absolutely losing, well, apparently absolutely losing her shit, only to be drowned out of a twee burst of flute that wouldn't sound out of place in the Belle and Sebastian album. And I thought that was a bit of a jarring, but then I thought about the majority of my sexual experiences, and most of them were followed by Belle and Sebastian. None of them lasted 16 and a half minutes. But
I would leap to its defence, because when you've got a groove that good, I don't care if you throw in a bassoon solo. You can throw anything on there for me. Keep it going. I could listen to that groove all
day. It's a
day.
Filthy bass line.
That's how you produced it.
It was produced by a man called Pete Tabalot, who I think was possibly involved with Donna Summer at that point, and Giorgio Moroder.
Because obviously Moroder isn't as prominent on that. You know, I Feel Love is pretty steamy too, not quite as explicit, but yeah, I think his involvement was a little bit more removed in this.
He helped write it. I think he was also partly responsible for taking what was initially a 3.5 minute pop song and extending it
for
16 minutes. And it was, he's credited with being one of the first kind of extended mixes that got played at discos, and one of the kind of archetypal disco songs. So it's important in that respect as well. But I think linking into this week's theme, it's one of the steamiest, very heavy-handedly sexy songs.
The song I was referring to, I think, is maybe more successfully steamy for me, is Minnie Riperton. For me, she was far naughtier, far steamier a musician than Donna Summer was. Donna Summer was almost potentially a little bit safe. This doesn't quite suit her here. You know, stick her in a pair of roller skates and I'm all for it, but Minnie Riperton in Inside My Love is singing You Can Come Inside Me, you know, in 1979, are we talking? Maybe earlier?
Maybe before, maybe, yeah.
It's a sequence of songs. I mean, obviously, times were more liberated and that started off in the 60s. I think it's a sequence of songs that started with Serge Gainsbourg, didn't it? Featuring Jane Birkin and Je T'Aime, had potentially even raunchier sex sounds. And I think it continued. I think if we're going for each decade, if that was the 60s, I'm thinking in the 80s, the second Summer of Love, do you know French Kiss, Little Louis? Who can have the most authentic orgasm on tape?
She says that when she was initially quite uncomfortable with the lyrics, and that she had to imagine herself as someone else while she was recording it, and pitched herself as Marilyn Monroe. But she was She was asked repeatedly about what happened in the studio when she was recorded it, and just from an interview in 1976, everyone's asking, "Were you alone in the studio?" "Yes, I was alone in the studio." "Did you touch yourself?" "Yes, well, actually, I had my hand on my knee." "Did you fantasize on anything?" "Yes, on my handsome boyfriend Peter, who also happens to be the producer of the song." So it does all seem very quaint and nice, and no one's really answering those questions. And I do also get the impression that maybe it wasn't something that she was entirely the agent of.
It doesn't seem quaint to me. It seems kind of exploitative to me. Mm. Right? Those questions are extremely exploitative, right?
And how do we know that Minnie Riperton wasn't exploited as well? Maybe more convincingly.
Yeah, indeed. puts a weird sort of sheen on all those songs.
Well, sorry, especially for ruining this one.
Yeah, no, especially as you know, what was it? No female had a self-penned number one to a Kate Bush, so I think there would be more or a different way to that song had it been written by Summer.
Probably would have been about God.
Right, thank you, Ian. Nathan, what have you chosen this week?
I've chosen Exile Vilified by The National. You got sucker's luck. Have you given up? Does it feel like a trial? Does it trouble your mind? Okay, let me start by saying I chose that song in part because I expected at least one of you to pick Steam by E17. So I thought I wouldn't be so obvious. My first question to you guys is, do you play computer games?
No is my answer.
No.
No, we don't.
Right, so Steam is an online gaming platform, sort of a cross between Spotify and Netflix, but for computer games. It's created by a company called Valve, who you may remember created games like Half-Life. They're also responsible for creating a series of games called Portal, which you may or may not have heard of.
Do you sort of, you jumped through a big circle and came out somewhere else?
Exactly, yeah. So the idea is a sort of puzzle game where you get from one end start of the level to another by creating temporal portals that you jump through.
Yeah, okay.
It features people like Steve Merchant, voices one of the characters, as does J.K. Simmons, who you remember from Whiplash, he voices one of the characters. And it's this really, Portal's this really strange meeting point of a lot of creative ideas, not just in terms of actors and game design, but also in music. Part of the music in Portal 2 was done using generative music. It's music that is written not ahead of time, so you don't have like a song sheet or a music sheet or anything like that. You program an algorithm or a series of algorithms, then depending upon certain inputs, output a particular type of music. So at the moment, there's actually quite a big scene in London called the generative music scene, where they try and create this auto-generative dance music, which is basically a bunch of nerds getting together, not actually playing any records, just writing code, and it outputting this sound. But where Exile Vilify comes in is it was a song that was written specifically for the computer game. The National, I think, contacted Valve and expressed interest in working with them, and then Valve agreed it was a good idea, and they produced this song, Exile Vilify, which is supposed to, in some way, fit elements of the narrative. It's not immediately obvious where you would hear it. In fact, to hear it, it's an Easter egg. You have to delve into a secret part of one of the levels, and then you find this room in which there are lyrics scrawled on the wall, and then there's this little radio thing, the music from Exile Vilify is played. Now, I tried to dig into why it was the National thought it would be a good idea to write a song specifically for a computer game. It just seems like a completely commercial decision. So the quote was, I think this is from one of the National's marketing team, "The National's raw and emotive music evokes the same visceral reactions from its listeners that the Portal does from its players. It was an exciting privilege to bring together two exceedingly talented creative teams to create something special." Now that is pure marketing bullshit, right? I mean, the song's good, the game's brilliant, but if you then take a look into the commercial aspects, I think High Violet, which is the record that the National released in 2010, just before this game was released in 2011, I think they sold 600,000 copies of High Violet, whereas Portal 2 shifted something like 6.5 million units. So it was a commercial decision.
So why can't it be seen as a collaboration then, like we see other musicians?
And in the same way that you'd see bands and art and musical artists collaborating with filmmakers, featuring films and music. Is it not similar to Martin's point? Is it not something that's similar to that?
No, I agree if you're being generous, yeah. But if you, again, reading that marketing blurb, it doesn't sound like it's much of that was involved at all, right? I'd like to think it was, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be.
Maybe this is more a critique on marketing blurb in general.
Yes.
Did you say that some of it was influenced by generative music?
So the rest of the soundtrack was recorded by a guy called Maborski. Correct me if I'm wrong, listeners. And that was all generative. I think they probably sat down together. If you listen to read the interviews between the guy who recorded the rest of the soundtrack, he was very interested in limiting the number of sounds, the kind of sounds that you might get from that sort of environment. He didn't want to go beyond that. So I expect that, yes, this track was influenced by those ideas for sure.
Because I was trying to get the time signature and I couldn't get it. It was very unusual.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And okay. I thought the introduction of various instruments was really interesting as well. Beautiful at times, but the strings came in not when you were anticipating it, but it had the organic feel to it. It was really very beautiful in a really unformulaic way.
I think that's a national trope.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, the Desners do a lot of modern classical work, quite progressive things. Yeah. So that doesn't sort of jump. Well, it did put me, when we were talking about the generative thing, I don't know, did you hear about this artificial intelligence Christmas carol?
No.
So some scientists programmed this thing called neural karaoke, essentially. And what it does is it scans a picture and it works out certain elements of that picture and turns that into a song, a very basic song. But it did it to a picture of a Christmas tree and it auto-generated a song. Lots to decorate the room. The Christmas tree is filled with flowers. I swear it's Christmas Eve. I hope that's what you say. The best Christmas present in the world is a blessing. I've always been there for the rest of our lives. 1.5 hours ago, I'm glad to meet you. I can hear the music coming from the hall. A fairy tale, a Christmas tree. There are lots and lots and lots of flowers.
Wow.
So evocative. Yeah. Christmas.
But listen to it. I couldn't stop listening to it for a week. It was quite incredible.
I like that the AI is so rich in there. There's that one lyric. I hope that's what you say. But I hope I'm coming across as human enough. It's almost like that paranoid android sort of.
That's very interesting. Another thing about the Portal 2 game is that it was used by teachers in America to teach maths and physics. That they decided to create this Portal for Teachers engine, which allowed teachers to basically create their own levels and teach their children about physics and stuff.
We're going to move on to my choice, which is Steam and Sequins for Larry Levan by Matt Moss. Matt Moss are experimental electronic artists from San Francisco who have become better known for the concepts behind their albums than for the tracks themselves. They're obsessed with field recordings. Their debut album featured a field recording of the nerve activity of a crayfish. Later on, they had an album called A Chance to Cut is a Chance to Cure, featuring samples of medical procedures, including plastic surgery, liposuctions, bone sawing. The Marriage of True Minds from 2013, where test subjects were put into sensory deprivation, and then Matt Moss tried to transmit the concept of the next Matt Moss record into their minds. And the images that they reported having seen then became the basis for the album. Last year, they released an album called Ultimate Care 2, consisting entirely of sounds produced by the musician's Whirlpool Ultimate Care 2 washing machine. But this track, Steam and Sequins for Larry Levan, comes from 2006 album The Rose Has Teeth in the Mouth of the Beast. The concept behind it is that it consists of biographical sound portraits of historically and culturally important gay figures. So, for example, RAG for William S. Burroughs uses the field recordings of the printing press and a typewriter. Solo Button for Joe Meek is a 60s surf rock anthem in tribute to the producer. Snails and Lasers for Patricia Highsmith uses snails recorded moving within the range of a theremin. Highsmith kept hundreds of the things as pets. And most bizarrely, Tracts for Valerie Solanas, who was a radical feminist and writer of the Scum Manifesto, who went to jail for attempting to murder Andy Warhol, uses the uterus and vagina of a cow as instruments. They're all quite difficult to listen to, believe it or not. Except this track, which reproduces the steamy atmosphere of New York City's Paradise Garage, for me, really quite accurately. The horns, the bump, the bass, it's as if it's a Larry Levan production come to life. But what it beautifully does as well, to be historically accurate, to be a biography, is that period in the late latter part of the song, the last minute or two, which get really quite dark, reflects Levan's own dark period of his life, namely the heroin addiction in the late 80s and early 90s before his death. But in terms of steam, it just conjures up an image of the dance floor in the Paradise Garage, bodies crammed together with steam, and Larry Levan appearing, diva that he was, through a doorway of steam, sequins everywhere.
I thought it sounded like a complete pastiche of all those kind of disco tropes, and they'd shoved in everything they could think of that was a kind of disco signifier and tried to cram it all together and in a really quite cack-handed way. And I mean, as a tribute to Larry Levan, Larry Levan was the master of taking a song which probably should have been 4 minutes at the most and spinning it out and out and out and out and out, but he used the same elements for 10, 12, 15 minutes. And that's what made him brilliant, is that repetition. And I just feel like they've completely missed the point of something like his version of Ain't That Mountain Within a Life, which is just over 10 minutes of this, basically the same idea for that time. It goes up and down and it ebbs and flows, but it's absolutely perfect. Whereas that was just too many ideas. It was a geek's idea of a disco record.
I completely agree. Completely agree with Ian on that point. And what struck me is that the list of ideas that you, the concepts that you read off, they sound like interesting ideas, but are they, in this case at least, it seems like to me they've resulted in bad music.
I completely disagree with you. I think they would lose sight of who they were as Matmos if they didn't produce something like this. This is dance floor ready. This is a bump and grind disco anthem in its own right, produced by people who are outsiders to club culture. They don't necessarily sit there listening to all of the Larry Levan edits that have ever existed. They would have done their homework, that's right, but they're coming to it from a very experimental avant-garde place. And to still have produced a song which you can definitely dance to, I think is credit to them. There's nothing else like it in their catalogue whatsoever. I think it's an absolute triumph.
You probably know more about them than me, but I got an archness from it that I found really, really jarring. And it sort of embodies all those cliches that are levelled at experimental musicians, in that it's far too clever for its own good, and the output is, why you wouldn't listen to any number of Larry Levan remixes or Larry Levan tracks above that before you listen to that, I don't know.
I think if he was still alive, I think he'd be flattered by it, and I think he'd be tempted to play it in one of his DJ sets. I genuinely do.
Quite possibly. I mean, it's got that very, when was it, 2006? So it kind of almost sounds of its time in that sense, like when that very sort of skittish electronica stuff was quite prevalent.
Yeah.
And I must admit, I was big on that track then and I'd forgotten about it. And it was nice to hear it. I probably would have preferred to hear anything else related to Larry Levan, in all honesty, there.
So, another problem with this track for me, perhaps Matt Moss, who I haven't heard before this, but is the how serious are they about this idea of paying tribute to Larry Levan? And there's this ironic distance that just, I think even if it were to cut out some of the actually jarring sounds, like Ian says, this amalgamation of all these things that you hear in disco tracks jammed together, it just doesn't sound, it just doesn't sound like being serious about it. It sounds like they're recording it with a raised eyebrow. And
I think that's often the part, like, it brought Matthew Herbert to mind for me. I don't know if you're aware, he, a similar man whose ideas and lofty intellectualizing perhaps stand in the way of good tunes early on in his career, you know, he could remix some stuff and make some, and he has made some brilliant records, but you know,
he knows how to work a dance floor though. I think that's the difference between he might have these weird kind of ideas of an album which is the life cycle of a pig from birth to death in the abattoir, but actually he's a really good DJ. Larry Levan was a master. You listened to any of the recordings of his set from Paradise Garage of taking you on a journey, but you didn't really know you were being taken on that journey. It's so smooth and goes from one record to another.
You know, in a film when a British actor is brought in as an outsider to that culture and can see it differently, or a director is brought in on a project which is very close to a lot of people's hearts, but he is an outsider and can present it in a different way. I find that fascinating, and I think this is exactly what's happening here. These guys are avant-garde experimentalists, and with emphasis on mentalists. And I think it's a fascinating document, what they've actually come up with, based on what they've heard, what they've researched. From the academic point of view, it's really fascinating, it's really catchy, and it's really danceable.
Apart from having it in the name, how much steam is going on?
There's a 7-second sample of steam hissing at the beginning, and like I said, the imagery is steaming bodies on a dance floor.
I will say that's the most enjoyable part of the track as well, that 7 seconds.
I was one of
the,
one of the reasons I asked about the samples is I was knowing a little bit about Matt Moss and their fascination with found sounds, and that there's that steam sample at the beginning. Did wonder have they used that for the hi-hat sound. I was thinking a bit too clever, I think, but no, they just let off a fire extinguisher at the start, and that was that.
I mean, you could, if you're being clever, obviously, Larry Van's performing act early on was the Peach Boys. So we have gone from the Beach Boys to the Peach Boys.
No, absolutely. And funny enough, the Beach Boys, I hope this goes in my favour, they filed a lawsuit. The Beach Boys filed a lawsuit against Larry Levan and the Peach Boys because they sounded too alike.
And they became the NYC
Peach Boys. Yeah. So again, I win. Wow, I'm going to win today. Again. Should we find out if that's true?
Confidence
or not?
There.
Richard, you kicked off this week. Who are you voting for to win?
I have not had a week where I've enjoyed each song so much. For its literal steam, I'm sticking with my own Beach Boys Steamboat.
Ian?
I'm also going to stick with myself because I think mine was the one that was most accurately portrayed the dictionary definition of steamy, so I'm going to stick with myself as well.
Nathan?
I thought your song was terrible, Martin. So I can't go for that one.
Just because you didn't like the song?
Yeah, I disliked it that much.
We're voting on the argument.
Well, no, I can't. Blinded by how much I didn't like
it. I think your argument's rubbish as well.
And I can't. I just feel a bit weird about voting for a song that so clearly exploits the female sexual
object.
We
destroyed that one for everyone, didn't we?
And mine was rubbish, so Rich, I'm voting for Rich.
Thank you. I feel a bit sorry for myself, so I'm going to vote for Steamy Sequins for Larry Levan, which means this week's winner is Richard with the Beach Boys. Congratulations, Richard.
Thank you. That one's for Carl Wilson.
That's all for this week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.